Circe Olson-Wessner, the Executive Director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Together We Serve. I am speaking with Hudson Bill Phillips, who is a brat who it looks like he graduated in 1952 from Heidelberg.
So that was the first graduating class from the Heidelberg High School, as it was at Patrick Henry Village. And the first half of my year at Heidelberg, my senior year, was at the Bunsenschule on Quinkenstrasse, which was a school that was formed by Thomas Bunsen, who was the inventor of the Bunsen burner. And it had two entrances, Damen and Herren. One for girls and one for boys, and we didn't pay attention to the entrances, but that was the old format. And we moved in the middle of the year to what became Heidelberg High School, and our class were the first classes to graduate in 1952.
Now you know that they closed it this year, Heidelberg.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
It's sort of sad, but understand. Why that happens. That's part of the military process, and you know that. And fortunately, the military is not a permanent organization that we will have, hopefully, we don't have it forever. We won't need it forever, but it nevertheless is what we do now. And and we are born in it, and military brats are born in it, and we accommodate ourselves and learn how to make the most of our very unique heritage.
So we're actually at the Overseas Brats Gathering in New Braunfels, and so you're wearing a name tag, and it says that you were in the Canal Zone in the 40s, but you actually were born...
1933 in Hawaii at Schofield Barracks. There was a territory at the time. Hawaii wasn't a state in 1933. And I learned later, visiting in Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, taking my father to Wilford Hall Hospital, that as we passed under the sign Wilford Hall, my father looked up and he said, "Wilfred." And I said, "What do you mean?" My dad had never been there before, and he said, "Oh, don't you know, son? He was with you. What do you call it when you're born? He delivered you."
Oh.
And I said, "No, I didn't know that." And he said, "Well, look on your birth certificate when you get home." I did, and it said Captain Wilfred Hall, and had been my doctor, and he then became a general and very important in medical history. But I figured, how much more can you be a brat than that?
Really? And this is they named a base for him then.
Yes.
So he obviously...
I began my brat career at Schofield Barracks. And as those of you have seen From Here to Eternity, the movie From Here to Eternity begins at Schofield Barracks with the men lining up and the bugle calls and so on. And it was the army of that period of time, with the men had tailored uniforms, took pride in their uniforms, and wore the campaign hats. And the officers still wore riding boots that came up to the calf. And my father was an army chaplain, but I have an old set of spurs that were the part of his uniform when he wore those boots. And he wore what's called a Sam Brown belt, which went across, it was a leather belt with a strap that went across the shoulder. It was a different kind of military at that time. I think we were about the 18th standing army in the world in terms of size, somewhere around the same size as Portugal. And the officers seemed to know each other all across the board. My father's number was 018653, which, if those of you know how those numbers are figured out, that is a very low number. And he was in 30 years and had a very full experience. And I tagged along with him. And you ask about the canal zone. I was at Fort Sherman, which was a coast artillery post, which became outdated after World War II because the Coast Guard just was totally impractical to really guard an area. And it became a jungle training place. And it was, my house was surrounded by jungle. The monkey bars behind my house, I found a boa constrictor, and we had to get rid of the boa constrictor, but I would take walks in the jungle as far as I dared, and it looked like something out of the Reader's Digest or the National Geographic in terms of being a post with palm trees and jungle and green and land crabs running about and lizards and all kinds of reptiles and insects. We all were over inoculated from malaria and yellow fever. And the children at my age of eight, my friends all had purple patches all over their legs and arms that came from fear of impetigo and incidences of impetigo, and the silver nitrate that they use for that would turn purple. And so that was just taken for granted, that my friends would all have these purple spots all over their legs. But we were given all kinds of medications and shots and everything from where we lived. I went to school in the third grade in Cologne, which was across the bay. Limon Bay was the name of the bay, at the mouth of, just before you get to the canal, coming out of the Atlantic. And to go to my school, we had to cross the bay in whatever boat they could find. Some little packet boats, tugboats, whatever was convenient. And I made that trip two times a day, going and coming.
So who ferried you across? The locals, or?
I think there was probably locals that ran the boat. And then an interesting thing happened in my first year there, the arrival of the General Humphrey, which was a Staten Island ferry that they brought down from Staten Island, and they redid it, kind of put boards along the sides and everything, and brought it down across the Atlantic into Cologne, into the bay there, to be used to cross back and forth from where I was. And we had often ridden the General Humphreys when we lived in, my father was at Governor's Island. Mm-hmm. And at that time I lived at the Statue of Liberty, which was they had an old military post there that had some quarters for the overflow from Governor's Island. And so I lived there for about a year and a half.
Wow. It's amazing you're mentioning these places that obviously no longer exist.
Yes.
And it's fascinating. So your father was a chaplain, you said?
He was a chaplain. And when the war started, we were at Fort Davis in the canal zone, and there was a great deal of fear that the post was going, that the canal would be attacked. And as it turned out later, there were plans to possibly do that. Was one of the options that the Japanese had. And I'm sure I'm getting ahead of myself here, but he was he still wore the uniform of the old pre-war army. Mm-hmm. And when we were put under alert, everything changed on the posts, and the the men wore the tin helmets of the First World War. They suddenly started showing up wearing those metal helmets ready for it to be bombed. And the family were all given gas masks, and even the maid had a gas mask. And our house is up on a high hill coming into Fort Davis. We obviously were really sitting ducks. We had barrage balloons on cables all around the post, around our house. Big piles of sand were deposited behind the house, and I asked my father what the sand was for, and he said that was for bombs, that incendiary bombs, phosphorus bombs. And he explained all of this to me. My third grade teacher at Gatun had us all immediately learn how to jump under our desks. And Gatun, the school there was a very modern school with big windows, airy place where you could see everywhere when you're inside the classroom. But it also could easily be shot through by planes. So we were told by the teacher, quite frankly, that we would be in great danger if a plane came by. And so that was something, that another indication of the beginning of war. And my dad's duties changed quite a bit at that time. And suddenly he became a chaplain that had experience and would be used to train other chaplains that were coming in. And eventually we were moved to the United States. But my family, my dad had, at the point of the attack and the following weeks afterwards, they began to evacuate quietly evacuate the dependents. And at Christmas, and Pearl Harbor was 1941, and at the Christmas celebrations and so on, we were standing around the Christmas tree, and I asked my dad, I noticed that only half of the people I knew were there. And I said, what's happening? Evacuated. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, that means that they're going home. And I said, oh, we'd be going home. And he said, oh, no, because you're a chaplain's family, and it would not look good if the chaplain's family left early. So we were among the last ones to leave, and we didn't leave until February, I think, or somewhere around there, of 42. Mm-hmm. It could have been February. Anyway, we left under a great deal of pressure. There's a picture, if you see the film, that Donna Musil had produced. There's a photo of my family in it. It has my brother and sister and myself and by the Christmas tree and our toys. And the statement made when the pictures are shown is, this is an indication of the anger that is bottled up by, perhaps, when these kind of things happen. And at the time, I didn't, years later when I looked at the pictures, I didn't think about that. But then in retrospect and looking back, I remembered that my father was quite angry, and he was keeping this quiet about our leaving and everything. But he suddenly wanted to take pictures of us. And he became very upset when we were laughing and not taking him seriously. And we thought this was silly. We had been through Christmas and so on. But he wanted us to pose with our toys. And I had a pet monkey that my sister had in her lap. And he had us all grouped together. And we all looked like It's a strange picture because it's a Christmas picture. And it should be joyful, or we should be laughing or something. And we all look alarmed, and we all looked kind of stunned. And I look at my brother and sister, and we all have variations of how we, at that age, and appropriate feelings that you would have if you were commanded to do something that you thought was
strange.
Yes. And but anyway, that's in the Brat film. And if you recall that or go back and look at it, you will see that picture.
Was your father taking pictures because he thought he was going to war and this would be a memory he would have?
Yes, and I'm sure he said to us, it's going to be a long time, and I don't know when
I'll see it. But you didn't know at the time.
And I was the oldest, and so I was stuffing a lot of this and trying to do what I was supposed to do. And my father told me, here's a bag full of necessary items in case you were separated or something. And he put it, I could still walk in my quarters, old quarters there, and show, and walk right into the kitchen. And there was a little secret door on the side for the pantry or something. And that's where I was to go to get food items and things. And I was to take them and go and sit on the front steps with my brother and sister and wait to see what happens, wait for somebody to pick me up. And
you were going to be the man of the house and take care of the family.
Yes. And then as we went down to the dock, I was more and more told, and my mother, had turned out years later, we realized that she had, she was bipolar, but it was never diagnosed. And so she was kind of unsteady in terms of taking on these responsibilities. And we were expected to go to find a home in the United States, and being like most brats, we had no home in the United States.
Right.
And it was wartime, and homes were not rented out very easily during that time, and so it was pretty stressful. And then I noticed when I was getting on the boat, first of all, it wasn't brightly colored as it had been when we came across. It was quickly splotched with a brownish green color.
Camouflage.
And in front of the boat was a minesweeper. And I said, what's that? And they had mines all around the side of the boat that were ready to throw out. And I noticed warships around. And my dad said, oh, we're going to have an escort ship. And I said, well, what do we need an escort ship for? And he said, well, it's because there's U-boats all along in the Gulf of Mexico and Caribbean. And that was the height, well, they found out later, that was the height of the time when the German U-boats. And sure enough, after about a day, they felt that there was a U-boat following us. Well, so from that point till we got to New Orleans, we were watching for U-boats, and the kids my age were running around looking for U-boats all the time. The mothers were in the staterooms, in the staterooms, writing letters and smoking cigarettes at that time, and the kids were running around the deck. And they divided up the family so that the boys my age and older, in terms of lifeboat drills, we went with the men, and so I had this every day, running to the station where you go down to the lifeboat, and rope ladders going down, and we had to remember where our life preservers were and everything. And I was so afraid that I would mess it up, that I would get in the way of somebody, but I was the youngest in my group, and anyway, we did that every day, going to New Orleans. I don't know, probably at that time, it probably took us about 3 days or 4 days to make that trip. And we got to the mouth of the Mississippi, and all of a sudden, my mother came in and she said, we don't need to worry about submarines anymore. And I felt such relief, because I'd been so worried about it. And I thought, well, we're okay. Coming back to the United States, where we got to New Orleans, and first of all, we had to get through customs, and people were all hysterical about the customs because they had such short notice, and what military family can go through customs in a few days' notice where they don't even know their belongings, they don't know what they left behind, what's with them, and so my mother was very upset. And when we went through the processing, going through the various authorities and so on, my sister had a Chinese doll that she got for Christmas, and it's a rag doll or cotton doll, and the man just cut the back of it. Just took a knife.
Oh no.
And he said that he wanted to be sure we didn't have any secret messages in it or anything. And then I went and stood in line to get a comic book, because I was out of my collection, and I read on the way over, and the first comic book I saw was a picture of one of the terrible, grotesque ideas of what Japanese look like, a man with buck teeth and thick glasses and holding a big knife and sticking it in Uncle Sam's back or something. And that was on the cover of the comic book. And then it was all about war heroes and people blowing up submarines and destroyers and so on. And so that was my introduction to the United States. We had USO tables around. People were, our people, the ones who got off the boat, were asking all kinds of questions about the United States in wartime. And this was wartime.
Right.
And we suddenly experienced it right off the bat in a whole different atmosphere in the United States. And people were yelling out, you know, asking about Singapore, is it falling yet?
I have a question. So you talked about the comic book. The military, had you met any Oriental people prior to this? So you knew as a child that that was a stereotype, or had you never met anybody who was Japanese?
Well, in Panama, they have a pretty sizable Chinese community. And back then, they had Chinese. And they have an uneasy relationship with other people in Panama in terms of the strata of definitions of the different groups. But we used to always go to a Chinese curio store in Cologne. And so I knew the Chinese people there, and they dressed in costumes that looked like something out of Tintin or something, with a kind of Manchurian looking and so on. But nice smells of sandalwood and all kinds of things. But I was used to having lived in Hawaii and everything, and Panama, all the different colors, and I accepted that as being what humanity looked like. And
you had mentioned earlier that you were going to talk a little bit about when the African Americans came into the military. So,
well, we saw very little of African Americans until 1947. I was at Randolph Field, and I did know of that we had one side of the post. There were two baseball diamonds, and one side of the post was the Randolph Ramblers, which is this almost famous service team that had a lot of professionals in it that had come into the military. Enos Slaughter of the St. Louis Cardinals, who had been in the Randolph Ramblers. There were many others. That was pictures around the walls from the days of the service. And that was, of course, after the war. But at the other side was a diamond where the blacks that were there, that they would play. We never saw them play. We were heard that they were pretty good. But their diamond was poorly kept up. And I was with a group of guys that were just typical brats from that age of about 12, 13, 14 just wander around getting in trouble, looking in, poking their nose into everything. And somebody opened the door of the equipment room over where the diamond where the blacks played. And the only piece of equipment I saw there was a dusty kind of cracked catcher's mitt. And I thought, how different from the Randolph Ramblers with all of their professional equipment and everything. What I saw of blacks were people fixing our sewer line or doing some menial task or then the many waiters that we would see on the boats going and coming across that would be very, you know, big smiles and doing all the things that white people kind of like and make them feel secure. But I didn't have any concept of blacks in uniform, really. I was at the shallow end of the officers club pool on a summer day in 47. The pool was the mecca of the post for military kids. That's where you met people. That's where you spent your days during the summer. This young man, I'd say young, maybe about 28 or so, and kind of good looking, if I could think in terms of what white people thought of blacks in terms of who's good looking and who isn't, and a bit of light skin color. And he came to the tip of the shallow end by the front of the steps, and he stopped. He had on a bathing suit, and he just looked out at this whole panorama of people swimming. And he just had a look on his face, a neutral look. He didn't look scared or anything. And then he started walking down the steps of the pool. And those of us in the shallow end, all eyes were riveted on him. And I think they almost expected an oil slick to come out when he put his feet hit the water. They thought there was going to be this oil slick that came out from this man. And he came in and he went down the steps and he kept looking straight forward. He took another step, came into the water, and then he got in the water and he kind of made his arms go back and forth to kind of splash the water around. And then everybody just returned. It was like in a movie where you suddenly start the frame again. And then life went on, and I say that was integration as far as I was concerned.
That's amazing.
That was the moment for me that the military integrated. Then I realized it's allowed. It's allowed. So that's my, this moment that stuck in my brain. Then I thought back and I thought, you know, he probably was a Tuskegee Airman, because who else would be officers?
Right.
So he probably was a Tuskegee Airman at Randolph Field at Air Force
Base. Right, exactly. So let's move a little forward to when you moved to Germany. So after the war and after Randolph, then did you go to Germany or?
We went to Arkansas, Fort Smith, Arkansas, which was a town of Fort Smith, and the name of the post is Camp Chaffee. And my dad was used to train chaplains. He did a lot of training with chaplains. There I experienced being a brat among civilians. I think in the whole experience there at Fort Smith, I only knew about six brats in the whole time I was in that year of high school there. They all were in the same boat that I was in, where they were trying to find some way to fit into the school. I think I was the only one that went out for all sports and did, like in the Great Santini, where the boy is in sports and trying to fit in. And I went out for basketball and track and football and didn't do very good in any of them, but I learned that I met people quickly that way. My dad was transferred to to Fort Sam Houston, and he was the post chaplain.
In San Antonio.
In San Antonio, and we were there. I was going to Texas Military Institute.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And while I was at Fort Sam Houston, I had two big experiences. Our quarters were right near the main artery that goes through Fort Sam, and they were the houses where the colonels lived. And the house just behind was a smaller house than the other houses, and I thought that's kind of odd that they would have one quarters that were different. And I guess it was used by the housing people for odd situations. Well, General Wainwright, who had been the general at Bataan,
mm-hmm.
Had become the, he was the general for the 4th Army, and he had just retired, and he was from the old Army days. And so there were a lot of hoopla about that, the horses coming out of the woodwork and stuff, and parades and so on. And then they had to figure out what to do with the general, because he was single.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was put in these quarters, and I didn't know that he was there. And I was, had somebody got me to cut the grass there, and I was mowing the lawn, and this lady came out and said, "Would you like to come in and meet General Wainwright?" And I was in my lawn mowing clothes, and about a 16-year-old boy, all sweaty and everything. And so I came in, and he was sitting on the couch, and seemed very interested, asked me what I wanted to do with my life, and very pleasant. He gave me a generous autograph, and I was very thrilled by that. Well, then, I won't tell too many more stories about this, but the next figure was General MacArthur, and he was coming back from Korea after mm-hmm. he had been kicked out, and he had his family with him, and I had a call in the middle of the summer while I was going to Texas Military Institute, and the colonel said, "Do you still have your uniform?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Can you get, is it all right to wear?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Will you be on the honor guard to greet General MacArthur when he comes in from Korea? He's coming through here because he went to Texas Military Institute when he was a boy." So I went to the airport, and then I went to the Alamo. He was laid a wreath at the Alamo, and then I greeted him at the military school when he came up the steps, and had the honor of saluting him, and he saluted us, and we saluted him. And so those are my two big heroes from the Second
World
War. And but then we got, my dad was moved over to Germany, and in 52-51, and he went a little bit ahead of us, and then we joined him. We went over on the patch, and we arrived at Bremerhaven, and got, when we got on the train at Bremerhaven, the one of the train people, a master, somebody came in, and he had a uniform that looked very much like a some kind of fancy Nazi uniform.
Mm-hmm.
We were all terrified. He came up. We thought, it's still going on over here. But we did like all the brats here that I've been talking to, where they all had these stories of point when they entered, mm-hmm. the getting over their first apprehension and so on. But anyway, while I'm going to speed this up, because I know I've talked a lot here, but while I was in Germany and being, and I went to Heidelberg High School and commuted and lived in the dormitory, and it was about a maybe a 200-300 mile trip on the train every weekend.
Every weekend you'd
yes.
go home? Uh-huh.
And we had trains at that time, they weren't sure about the water, so we had jerry cans everywhere we went. There'd be a jerry can at the end with water that had been taken care of and mm. prepared for us, and then usually you had a military policeman or sergeant or somebody that was appointed to kind of wander around the train,
making sure
trains.
You were behaving.
Yes, and checking on people, and Then we get in a bus, and it would take us over to the dormitory, which is a little small two-story building across from the school, and had a dormitory supervisor. And then we suddenly met a whole new bundle of brats that would become our friends. But during the summer, I won't go on about the schools, others have talked about the school, but during the summer, I worked two summers at a new Boy Scout camp that we were creating in Bavaria.
In Chiemsee?
It was near Chiemsee, was the Alitzsee.
Oh, okay.
And there was a little small lake at the foot of some small mountains, and you could see Neuschwanstein Castle from where we were.
Beautiful.
And the Alitzsee was a small, deep lake, very, very cold water, and there was a kind of narrow passage to get into the area. And they try to get you to leave your trucks and cars at the entrance, and then we had to walk in. And we set up our camp there, and the camp would go on for maybe about 4 years before it became they moved it to some other area. But we found out later, I noticed that there at night, there would be boats and various barges and things that were out on the lake, and we'd hear Germans singing, and the men would be out there dredging for something, and we couldn't figure out what they were dredging for. The water, nobody knew how deep the water was there,
right?
Because it was a mountain lake. But you start to get suspicious about what are they so worried about. We didn't see many signs of anything, but we found out later that had been used by the V-2 rockets, to prepare the V-2 rockets to shoot over to England and so on. And there was also the matter of, toward the end of the war, there was this myth, it turned out to be kind of a myth, or maybe it wasn't, that the Germans were going to have one last stand, and it was going to be in the area around Bavaria, and that they had hidden equipment all around through there, so we discovered that a lot of this equipment that was at the foot of the Alitzsee, then I found out later that in the town of Fussen, F-U-E-S-S-E-N, the little over the
the umlauts.
that town was extremely, had a lot of activity connected with V-2 rockets. And there's a scene in one of the newsreels of Werner von Braun when he was captured. And he's that famous picture of him, where he'd broken his arm in an accident or something, and his arm is in a sling, and he's smoking a cigarette and looking like a stereotypical Nazi, with a kind of a look, almost a smirk, as he's surrendering and becoming very valuable to the Americans. And it was not very far from the Fussen area. So it was ironic that the American Boy Scouts had replaced the V-2 rocket program, and every day, I was a bugler 1 year, and every day I blew bugle calls and blew to the colors and so on, and we did the flag ceremony the same way we do it on a military post, and some of the Germans that lived around there would come to watch us, and the Voice of America came and talked to me.
The radio station.
They were taping the bugle calls and taking pictures of some of the activities. So I know it was broadcast out someplace. The Germans that watched, we also were active with the Boy Scouts program of the Order of the Arrow, which I'm sure many brats took part in over there. Mm-hmm. And I was a member of the first ritual team that we had to call out honor scouts, and we had prepared, I'm a little embarrassed about the fact that we were trying to look like Native Americans, because I'm not sure what people see the pictures of how we looked, but we did have ornate costumes that we'd made. And the Germans would come around when on Friday nights when we had the calling outs, and they called it Indian Night. And among the Germans around
the
there,
Germans,
and
yeah.
they were thrilled by these German costumes. And I was made the first lodge chief of the Order of the Arrow Lodge. That they have lodges, and lodges have names and so on. And our lodge became the Black Eagle Lodge. And the Black Eagle Lodge still has the same insignia and so on, and I bet you some of the guys here are in the Black Eagle Lodge. And I didn't know, I hadn't heard much after this period of time, I hadn't heard what happened, but then I became somebody from that had gone on and worked with the Black Eagle Lodge said, do you know that it has now gone all around the world and that it's the largest lodge in the Boy Scouts.
Wow.
And one time I was listening, this is true, and I can't verify it, but I was listening to during the Desert Storm period, two generals were talking. One was being interviewed, and a general called him, and the first thing he said was Black Eagle Lodge.
And it was like they had been in it.
Yeah, they'd been in it.
Very
and
cool.
They were talking about Desert Storm, but that's right. How they identified themselves as Black Eagle Lodge.
Wow.
And you were
at the founding of that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I wasn't, you know, I probably if I hadn't been there and so on, and I mean other people were involved and so on and did a lot of the hard work, but anyway, that was and so. The scout experience was very important to a lot of scouts. One story that people don't know is that during my first year, little boys from Berlin came, a troop from Berlin, and they'd had to come through the East German sector.
On the train.
In the train, and they came, and they all were very well behaved and everything, and then all of a sudden this jeep showed up with some very serious looking MPs and people, and they said they wanted to interview those scouts. And they took them away in a mess hall and talked to them, and they had them write affidavits about the experience of coming through East Germany. And apparently, two of the boys, and I may be, and I, you know, just my memory we're talking about here, threw cherry bombs out the window of a closed train, and somehow got the windows open and threw cherry bombs into a
East Germany.
Passing East Germany and into one of their towns going through, and so it had risen to high circles, and so they wanted to verify that that's what happened. And so I heard some of the boys saying, well, I was eating my Baby Ruth bar and so-and-so, you know.
And the alibis were coming out.
But that's a story that I think is interesting to the things that happened over there.
So you've had such a rich childhood experience, and we have to wrap this up, but what is one memory, a good memory about being a brat? What is something special to you?
I don't know. I would say what's special is the discovery later of that other people, you know, that they were still alive. I mean, there's once you're out of the military, you lose contact, and then it becomes a matter of. Now, can somebody verify what happened? Did this really happen? People say, oh, you should write a book. That's one of the favorite things.
Well, I'm thinking you should write a book.
But what it says is, go over there and write your book and then stop talking. No. It becomes a case of how you present this in such a way that it has some kind of a currency in terms of what's meaningful to people,
right.
Other people.
Right.
Not just other people that had the same experiences. But it is important, and I find people have the same experiences, just to vindicate and to compare and have some objectivity. I think that for me, the being about important things have to do with some of the people I've met, and the early days of the military. My memories of the two-winged First World War. We lived at Selfridge Field, Michigan, and the days when the Air Force was the Army Air Corps, and it was used to deliver the mail. I remember seeing a movie called Dawn Patrol with Errol Flynn, and they were having dogfights with the two-wing planes, and these planes look just like the ones that were out on the, when you walk outside the theater and walk along, and I was so terrified, because it was like this was happening to the people that I knew as a little kid. But those early days were still very significant for me, and how different they were from now.
Right.
My father, when we went to Fort Sam, and we went to, I heard the, I was showing him around Fort Sam, where he had, when he was in his 90s or early 90s, and I heard the cannon go off. And I said, let's hurry and get over to the quadrangle and watch the flag come down. I think there was a boom, and then you have like about half an hour, or some 20 minutes or something before the flag comes down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Anyway, we got over there, and this was the new days, and my dad comes out and he stands there, and these soldier, man and woman, come out, and neither one of them had hats on. They were sloppy looking. And they were indifferent. And then they had a recording
of the
they didn't have a bugler. And I thought, I was embarrassed for my dad, you know, and I thought, but he was so military and so serious, he was saluting, and to him it was, you know, didn't care about that, but that kind of thing is something that'll always be there.
You know, our museum's mission is to collect the culture. It's a cultural museum, and it's to collect the stories and the memories. Because even though we are separated generationally, you and I, and brats, my son is a brat, and he has nothing in common with you.
Yeah.
He has a lot in common with you, because the brat experience generationally mirrors. And so it's wonderful. Yeah. And he can relate to you with the cannons. He can relate to you with the regiment. He can relate to you being the man of the family.
I said to my wife at Fort Davis over in West Texas, they have an old cavalry post. The very few buildings were standing, but they had the commanding officer's built house they're restoring, and it's at the part of the post where he could come out in the morning and stand on his front steps and see everything.
Right.
And I stood there and I said, you know, Betty, I said, if you got military, you know, some kind of archaeological thing there where they're trying to figure where everything was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I said, if you get a military brat and just turn him loose here in the post, he will tell you where the commissary was. He will tell you where the chapel was. He will tell you where the jail was, and he will do it in a short period of time, because the kids just know, and they have that feeling in every post.
Mm-hmm. They do. So we're going to have to wrap it up. I'm glad that the tape kept going. That's awesome. It was wonderful talking to you. I want to thank you, and I want to thank you for your long military brat service. And once again, this is Circe Olson-Westner, the Executive Director of the Museum of the American Military Family, and I've been speaking with Bill Phillips, and thank you so very much.